You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, May 28th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live different types of steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, historian Daniel Bessner. We're going to be talking about the uprising in Minneapolis and why, actually, given so many factors in today's society, we don't see more like this. We're going to talk about that from a historical vantage point, as well as the gig economy and the hollowing out of academia and how it affects the very production and understanding of history itself with Daniel Bessner. Still no charges for the four policemen who were accessories to or the murderer of George Floyd. Most everybody has seen the murder tape. Protests continue in Minneapolis, and folks reveal their quite obvious double standards with regards to these things, from political analysts to the police. 2.1 million more Americans have filed for unemployment, bringing the 10-week total to more than 40 million unemployed amid the corona outbreak, even as deaths pass 100,000. An avalanche of evictions is expected in the coming months as Americans are unable, increasingly, to pay their rent. A bipartisan revolt upends the vote to reauthorize FISA, potential good news. Donald Trump is throwing a tantrum and looking to sign, apparently, or has signed, a new executive order that might jeopardize sort of open communication on tech platforms, though how there was ever real open communication on privately managed monopolies is a mystery. Trump administration preps new arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And Boeing is firing 12,000 people, as even after being a beneficiary of the CARES Act, of course, no surprise there. White House considering breaking precedent and not releasing economic forecasts this summer because Donald Trump has plunged us into a pandemic depression. Barr appoints a Texas prosecutor to review Obama's unmasking of officials' request. The Guardian reveals that a new rebranded conservative shadow money group is working hard to suppress the vote in 2020. And tensions still high between China and India and Kashmir. New study adds to alarm of deforestation in Brazil under Bolsonaro, even after a wave of arrests implicate some of his backers and funders for spreading fake news and campaign funding irregularities yesterday across Brazil. All that and more on today's Majority Report. So I'll just say up front, always very excited to have Daniel Bessner on, and we will be able to speak to what's happening from this historic vantage point, from a historical vantage point in Minneapolis to some extent. But also, you know, this is also the nature of you know, the logistics that you know, we had this booked, and it's an important conversation, and maybe if there was you know, maybe things could have been with, you know, more filled out, more resources, basically. Maybe we could have, you know, punted to next week, but we weren't able to do that. So that's fine. I'm very excited for that conversation, but I do want to just sort of, you know, let people know the thought process and some of the logistics around this as well. What's happening in Minnesota is in no way surprising. Frankly, shocked things like this don't happen more. The officers have still not been charged. And I want to be very specific. I think charges that they could bring would be second degree murder for the cop that murdered George Floyd on tape, and certainly accessory charges for the other three officers. When it was announced that they had been fired, of course, they need to be charged with murder. But when it was announced that they had been fired, that was an extraordinary signal at how horrifying this tape was going to be, that the police department or the police union didn't even attempt to spin this one. So the result, of course, demonstrations, there's a violent and aggressive police response. We'll go into some of the obvious disparities between how people protesting a member of their community being murdered in cold blood versus a bunch of assholes trying to handcuff democracy at the Michigan State House, the disparities in treatment. I'm also, you know, I think some people are, you know, I think, frankly, the result of this is probably increased policing. I think we can't confuse absolutely justified rage and action. And I'm very concerned, frankly, about there not being a wave of arrests for these things and more killing and more violence from the police. But I also don't, I wouldn't confuse this with shifts in policy. In fact, some of the shifts in policy probably will amount to things like more surveillance cameras and even more aggressive quantitative police tactics. So this is where we are. After Ferguson, the Obama administration made some small steps in terms of consent decrees, in terms of attempting to put some DOJ oversight on these issues. Those were pulled back immediately when Jeff Sessions was attorney general. Obviously, it would have been done the same, I'm sure, by Bill Barr. And we have a serious problem in this country. It's obviously along the lines of racism policing. It's also, frankly, a huge over-violence and over-policing across every economic metric. I mean, basically everybody who isn't rich relative to any other industrialized country in the world faces extremely aggressive policing here. There's also, go ahead.
I just want to share, this is from 2010, but I imagine it hasn't changed much. Percentage of officers who live in each of the cities within the 75 largest police forces. So cops that actually live in the cities. If you scroll, you have to scroll basically all the way down to the bottom here by Minneapolis with not like barely even like, if you guess double digit percentages for how many white cops live in Minneapolis, you'd be over guessing by double, because it's right. About 4% live actually in Minneapolis. The rest live in the suburbs around it.
Yeah. So, and also, as another kind of line of investigation, certainly some people I've talked to who have worked in law enforcement, you know, and so it's not conjecture, and there have been some reports this way. They say, look, you also need to, there's an overall problem of policing and class and race and what neighborhoods get policed and how they get policed and how that interfaces with gentrification and using the police as tools of those policies. That's the structural macro problem. And then there's also the fact that undoubtedly there are people explicitly from white supremacist terrorist organizations that are interested in joining police departments, the military, And that's another thing that obviously needs to be aggressively investigated. So we're going to just play a couple of clips. First, let's play clip number two. You know, this is very significant too, because I also, you know, I wasn't necessarily, I mean, this is just the shift of what you saw people doing in Michigan. And you, and we'll get to the Tucker Carlson clip later, but it's extraordinary because this was it. If you had any kind of sincere belief, and obviously he doesn't, but if you, generally speaking, had any kind of sincere belief in we're having societal breakdown, the institutions can't function, a bunch of armed lunatics with extremist affiliations, let's use very, you know, mainline news language here. Let's pretend we're at ABC News, okay? Without masks, with extremist, racist, potentially neo-Nazi affiliations, go to the Michigan State House without masks, fully armed, terrorize the place. The session ends up getting canceled. Let's play a clip of that. I'm sorry, I didn't set this up properly. This is in contrast to police immediately coming out and starting to throw tear gas at people assembling in their community and saying, look, you're not doing your job. And that's one way of interpreting this, right? Your job is not to be here to murder and terrorize us. Your job is not to be here to murder someone in broad daylight on tape because they allegedly passed a $20 bill that was fake, and you had them subdued, and then you suffocated them while your colleagues secured the perimeter. So we're going to protest that. That's pretty obvious. These other folks are going to come out without masks because the, you know, Zionist world government is made up of fake virus or something. Let's contrast the different approaches here. So there you have it. And then this one, I mean, this is kind of an MVP moment that Benjamin Dixon, I found it from Benjamin Dixon. I don't know where it originally comes from. This is, look at this young woman running and basically throwing back a tear gas canister. Let's check out this clip. She runs, sees the canister, chucks it back, and she jogs back.
Hero.
That's a very impressive, very poised athleticism right there in those circumstances. She didn't flinch. She had a solid arc. She took it, she circled back. And that guy was watching her like,
nice. It reminds me of, it's like how, you know, in the NBA you learn from leagues across like Europe or wherever, like different techniques. Like I saw stuff like that happening in the Hong Kong protests, for instance. And it definitely happened in Ferguson. But like all this stuff is starting to look really similar across the world.
So, you know, I want to balance all these things. And I think... Obviously, the, you know, Ferguson, what actually happened in London, if people, this is almost like 10 years ago now at this point. I mean, these things and what's happening here, obviously, there's this serious insurrectionary response to racism, to disenfranchisement, to police violence. Where it leads, how it's mobilized, and also I think some people's tendency to try to graft onto it over social media, I think we need to be very tentative about, and we need to be incredibly cautious at what the upshots are of this. I'm imagining some, you know, blue ribbon commissions and some very concerned rhetoric. But I'm also imagining potentially even more aggressive surveillance and policing as well.
I mean,
and in the short term, I'll just shut up in a second. But these guys need to be charged. Yeah. And this isn't, you know, they need to be charged. This is a public health hazard in the highest degree that Derek Chauvin, Alexander Koenig, Thomas Lane, and Tao Thao have not been charged.
Yeah, and it's a scary, hopefully not a sign of a mayor unable to control a police force. And the right. scary thing is, you know, like, you look at Ferguson and what happened to the leaders that emerged from that, and a lot of them died mysteriously.
That's absolutely right.
It's right. terrifying. So, like, this is we need to be more vigilant this time around.
Yes, and there needs to be, you know, people are sending resources to help protesters. You know, you got to obviously scrutinize these things really carefully, but there's obviously going to be legal funds and other things to help when there's criminal charges. And then on the flip side, there's also this really serious push that we need for criminal charges against these four police, but also, potential civil charges as well. So there you have it. And we will keep focused. The last I saw just before we went on, I guess the mayor has requested that the National Guard come in. So we'll keep attending to this very closely. Are we going to take a break or are we going to go straight to Bessner?
I'll just bring him on now. How about that?
Okay, sounds good.
Hey guys, can you hear me?
Daniel Bessner, you're live and we can hear you. And Daniel Bessner is, of course, a professor of international affairs and diplomacy at the University of Washington. He's the author of The Defense Intellectuals. Hanspeyer and the Rise of the Defense Intellectuals, which is a really great book.
And Democracy in Exile is the...
Wait, yeah. Sorry, no. Tell me the full name of it. I don't have it in front of me. Tell me. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. It's called Democracy in Exile, Hanspeyer and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual. And it's essentially about how it came to be that so much of our foreign policy is driven by experts and academics and people like that.
Yeah, and I could tell you that as somebody who, you know, has to read a lot and definitely sometimes, you know, I mean, even books I really like can't necessarily read every single page. It's just the sort of nature of the beast. I ended up reading all of that book. So it's incredibly well written. It's great. And I definitely recommend people check it out. So
thanks,
I want to talk just you actually had a Twitter thread last week where you were asking as a historian, you know, and not you weren't like sort of thirsting for more, you know, for sort of like an outbreak of violence. But you were also just saying, you know, there's a lot of variables at place here. I mean, we've got, you know, 40 million people unemployed. We have a pandemic. 100,000 people have died. And Jeff Bezos is about to be the first trillionaire. We have this horrific, extreme inequality. We have all these other, you know, obviously things like, you know, police violence, murder and abuse, like we just saw with the murder of George Floyd. And you were saying, you know, just historically, it kind of actually is incredible that for all of the extremism in the United States, you know, particularly exemplified by like the Republican governing class and the violence of different state apparatuses, which you track because you also link the connections between foreign policy and policing tactics at home. That it's frankly kind of surprising you don't see more kind of insurrection like we're seeing in Minneapolis. So I guess, you know, what's your sort of broad take on that? I mean, take it in any direction you want to go.
Sure. So what really led me to think about that tweet is from my historical work. So if you look back at the first Gilded Age or the fin de siècle or the, you know, the Gilded Age into the progressive era, turn of the 19th into the 20th centuries, there's quite a bit of political violence across the North Atlantic. Dozens upon dozens of aristocrats are assassinated during that period. In Europe and in the United States, of course, you get Leon Czolgosz, a Polish immigrant, assassinating President William McKinley. So there's this decades-long period where there is a lot of anti-statist, particularly left-wing anarchist political violence that begins in roughly the 1880s and culminates, of course, with the assassination by Gavrilo Princip of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914, leading to the outbreak of World War I, right? It's sort of the end of the aristocracy, an era of incredible income inequality, wealth inequality that we hadn't really seen until recently, accompanied by a lot of political violence. Then you also turn to the 1960s and 1970s, and you see, if not quite the same outbreak, something relatively similar with the rise of groups like the Weather Underground in the United States or the Red Army Fraction, the Rote Army Fraction in Germany, of coordinated left-wing political violence, which is also linked to organizations like the PLO and Black September throughout the world as well. So it's a question that I've been asking myself for a while, just why don't you see that same sort of left-wing political violence? And I think it's difficult to come up with any single causal explanation, right? I asked the question on Twitter, and I think I got a lot of interesting responses. For example, people are not quite as desperate, particularly as they were at the turn of the century, in terms of literally going hungry, seeing a ton of their children die, even though infant mortality has increased in the United States, really being totally indigent for a very long time. And you don't quite see the same degree. You also do have things like the opium epidemic, widespread drug use, television, pop culture is much cheaper. Consumption in particular is much cheaper today than it was back then. And the consumptive capitalism of the 1960s and beyond is very critical to that. And so I think it's difficult to know, but I think taken together, those answers are probably right in some degree. But then, of course, ironically, less than a week later, you saw this outbreak of violence in Minneapolis in relation to the police killing of George Floyd. And so I think it's a really interesting moment. Now, the degree to which this is properly political violence or sort of an outbreak of rage, obviously one can't clearly separate those. But I think that's an interesting analytical question we could ask ourselves. But it does seem like similar to the riots, and the outbreaks of rage, I think is really the right word. Riot is too, you know, pejorative and charged. I think the outbreaks of rage we're seeing right now are similar to what was going on in the mid-1960s with the Watts event in 1965 and, of course, the so-called long, hot summer of 1967. So what is the cause of it now? Obviously, there's the initial impetus of the death, the brutal, violent supremacist, white supremacist killing of an innocent black man. But I think it's also linked to the fact that obviously people are fed up with the COVID-19 crisis. There's a lot of unemployment. And crucially, weather is actually a really important circumstance that helps lead to these outbreaks of violence. And I think I believe the best representations of this is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. If you actually see how sort of hot weather actually does spur people to acts of political violence and violence in general, is a really crucial way to understand what's going on now. But I do think we're going to need to take a step back in a few weeks and understand why this is happening now, and particularly if this is an impetus like what happened during the so-called Arab Spring in 2011. I think that's unclear right now.
Yeah. Can this actually be leveraged to have real radical policy changes? And then, of course, how will this be leveraged by, a Trump reelection campaign that can obviously, whip up a base with racial and anxiety driven appeals around this, which of course they've already been doing for quite some time. Now I want to play this clip of Tucker Carlson, because this is, you know, this is very, I think, clear just in terms of like delineating the different moves that are being made here. You know, everybody in this audience, or almost everybody in this audience, is already going to have, you know, understand that Tucker Carlson absolutely promotes fear, racism, bigotry. He very cleverly utilizes sometimes very sophisticated economic analysis to leverage for vicious and grotesque policies. But the language he's using here and this appeal to order is double. I mean, it's insincere, it's disingenuous, it's obscene, but it's also, I wanted people to understand it in the way of like the way he sort of knows how to program to folks with certain economic concerns. Now he's programming to another group that in some ways are kind of the Biden resistance types. This thirst for normalcy, this deep concern, not about injustice or what the murder of George Floyd represents or the fact that we're in a Great Depression or the fact that we don't have healthcare, but the fact that things are starting to feel, quote unquote, out of control. And obviously, you and I think that this way of, you know, assessing the world politically is entirely insufficient. But there are some people who, you know, I mean, Chris Cuomo actually was just making an ass of himself last night of saying, you know, like when the violence starts, don't you lose the moral high ground with, you know, this sort of ridiculous, sanctimonious liberal garbage. And I'm also sure that, you know, Chris Cuomo was somebody who didn't like people in Michigan showing up with automatic machine guns and not wearing masks. There's a broad sort of, and everybody sees the hypocrisy and problems in it, because of course, in this kind of broad reach for normalcy and quote unquote order, you're equating people who are expressing rage about a community member that's just been murdered in cold blood by police who literally they pay with their tax dollars. Let's use that. Let's remind ourselves of that. Pay them to murder one of their, you know, neighbors. And then also, you know, and then in Michigan, it's, you know, the first wave of kind of reopen protests, I think, did have misdirected economic anxiety because there is no proper bailout. But by the time we got to Michigan, it's just, you know, really can only be read as basically extremist violence subverting democratic norms and institutions in the United States. And that's actually, you know, for all the heated rhetoric, that really is like a proper way of contextualizing those. So the reason I give that long, long preamble is because Tucker Carlson, who, of course, caped for people, and, you know, he's very savvy. He knows how to, you know, condemn obvious outliers or what may or may not play well. But he certainly was not spending a couple of weeks saying showing up at the Michigan State House with machine guns is a form of tyranny and undermining American foundations of order. So look at how he does this.
So that's what rioting looks like. It happened last night. As you can see, it's happening right now. We want to be clear, we're not showing you these pictures to defend the behavior of individuals on the Minneapolis Police Department. We're not. We're defending society itself. Rioting is the one thing you don't want. Ugly opinions, police brutality, officious bird watchers, rude entitled ladies walking their dogs in big city parks. All of that is bad. But none of it is nearly as bad as what you just saw. The indiscriminate use of violence by mobs is a threat to every American of all colors and backgrounds and political beliefs. Democracy cannot exist when people are rioting. Rioting is a form of tyranny. The strong and the violent oppress the weak and the unarmed. It is oppression.
So can you just explain all the incredible moves he's doing there? And the you know, I'm not dwelling on the racism, the double standards are part of it and quite obvious. But I think the broader propagandistic moves, so as an example, equating systemic police violence with personal moral failings in a society where actually I think sometimes, you know, things do sort of get flattened in a social media feed where it's like, oh, okay, you know, this person made an ass of themselves and it can exemplify a bigger problem, but they just, you know, they made an ass of themselves and now they're having their day of shame on Instagram versus a, you know, state apparatus murderer. You know, we actually do need to delineate these things. He's making the other end, which is the murder of George Floyd is on the level of sort of like uncouth social etiquette. And the only thing that has any societal implications is actually an uprising in response to essentially state-sanctioned terrorism. But anyways, go ahead, please.
No, I mean, I think the way you just put it was really right. And I want to underline that this is something that you see throughout the history of modernity, which I take to begin with the rise of a real mass politics in the middle of the 19th century, is that you see the dialectic between outbreaks of rage like this, whether it's expressed in the labor militancy of the late 19th and early 20th century, aspects of the Black Power movement in the 1960s and 1970s, and similar types of outbreaks of political violence. And that arguments, the idea that you need to return to normality or you need to return to normalcy by basically increasing the cause of that violence, which is the state-sanctioned violence, is something that you hear throughout modern history. And I think this is what really unites, in a deep sense, the center with the right wing, is that the liberal idea and the conservative idea that that the true affront to democracy is not, as you said, the structural racist violence committed by the police against innocent individuals, or in a more real sense, innocent communities, is not what should be the focus. That is, in some meaningful sense, normal because it's part of state behavior. It's part of the state structure. And the way that's juxtaposed with this sort of what is presented by Tucker Carlson right there as abnormal violence is something that you see throughout modern history. And what that usually results in a variety of spheres, from domestic politics to international relations, is a centralization of authority in the so-called in the state that maintains monopoly of legitimate violence. And just to underline that, one of the things that I think the social theorist Max Weber, who wrote from the late 19th to the early 20th century, argued that I really believe is foundational to understanding modern politics, is that what makes the state, what makes it legitimate is that it contains a monopoly of the legitimate force of violence. Right. That is one of the foundational things that makes a state a state. In the police force, in the army, the state is legitimate because it is able to use violence legitimately. And what Tucker Carlson is definitely unknowingly doing is he's reifying and reaffirming that understanding of the state by saying what the state does is legitimate, even though, you know, we have some bad individuals. Obviously, the killing of George Floyd, Tucker seems to be saying, but was, you know, horrible. The real problem here is the violence of the democratic public, which is fundamentally illegitimate. And so this is a foundational way that people understand their relationship to state authority for the last 150 years. So the question is, if you're looking at it from a political perspective, I think is twofold. One is, how do you frame the outbreaks of rage as themselves as legitimate as the state use of violence? And two, to lead to two, which is convince fellow citizens that this is as legitimate a use of violence as state-sanctioned authority. And I think that's a really difficult question, because I think what you're indicating, and I think rightly, is that most people who are watching Tucker Carlson, certainly, but most people are not participating in this violence. They're generally not affected by large-scale political structures, even though that might be different during the COVID-19 crisis. Most people generally do want to return to so-called normalcy. Of course, this was the famous Warren Harding slogan in the 1920 presidential election. You know, he promised a return to normalcy. The question, though, is whether the actual COVID-19 crisis and then the coming of a Great Depression and the just total collapse of the legitimacy of the system, represented, I still do think, by the success of Donald Trump and to some degree by the success of Bernie Sanders, even though I clearly don't equate them in any meaningful way, whether that provides a political opening to begin questioning some of these foundational assumptions of state and state legitimacy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. So... Now, and one of the other big concerns about this too, I think, is the increase. I mean, and we could sort of use this as an awkward bridge to get to the other half of what we'll talk about. But even policing in general, can you trace, I mean, obviously from the inception, obviously policing in the United States has been inseparable from racism. It's been inseparable from clamping down on labor and other class dynamics. Now, I'll confess, I find, you know, sort of abolish policing to, you know, I'm just sort of not a fan of kind of slogans like that without a really specific, you know, programmatic agenda. And I also think that I know there is a specific programmatic agenda, but I guess I tactically I would lead in the reverse direction. I think you could actually bring a fair amount of people on board for a lot of the real kind of radical and absolutely necessary changes embedded in that, who might be sort of confused by that generic slogan. And, you know, that tracks with a lot of polling data. And I think one of the other things that, that would be concerning about it is I think, you know, today, if we sort of, if the attack on policing as a public institution from where there's political power would probably be more likely to turn it just into private corporate militias, who in addition to the racism and abuse capacities don't have even theoretical public accountability. Now, on the other hand, obviously we might start to see an emergence, and we did see this in Michigan. There was that great move of those local black businessmen who came in with assault rifles to escort the legislator to her job. That was positive and obvious and absolutely necessary. And if, you know, I mean, that that was so, so maybe there will be things like that that will emerge that will be positive. In the macro sense, if police departments start, you know, getting shaken up in major metropolitan areas in the current policy framework, that will mean more privatization. And I was hoping if you could maybe draw the analogy, because we know, just like with occupations overseas, there's obviously a huge civilian death toll from the Pentagon and U.S. military period. But then there, the enhanced use of private security contractors and sort of mercenary forces have added an even whole other dimension to it that we need to be very mindful of, particularly as policing tactics or military tactics from abroad, as well as artillery, have been, you know, brought to bear in police departments across the country.
No, I think that's a great point. And just before I get into that, just two quick things. If I recall correctly, I believe that the, some of, if not the first organized police forces in the United States were actually founded in the post-Civil War South, specifically to police freed slaves, the freedmen. Right. So it's from the very beginning in this country, directly linked to racial oppression. And just about slogans, I always thought a good slogan, if not abolish police, because I don't think that would find much to purchase right
now. That's not a good slogan.
Is policing equality, that you have to spend equal money on policing white collar crime as you do, you know, so-called blue collar crime or violent crime. I always thought that would be a good way to do it, where, you know, you police banking as much as you do, you know, quote unquote, inner city neighborhoods. But to get to your question about privatization, I think this is one of the fundamental features of the American state. So you have of the modern American state, which I date to roughly post 1945. So in the 1930s, as many people probably listening know, you get the New Deal and expansion of government authority. Beginning in the late 1930s and continuing throughout World War II, which not everyone knows, and into the post-war period, you basically get a conservative backlash. So what conservatives do is that they reconcile themselves to the reality of the New Deal in the sense that the American state is now larger than it's ever been before, and it has much more authority than it ever did. They didn't really think that would itself be pushed back. But what they do is they come together in reaction to create what I call a contract state. And I haven't heard that from someone else, but if I'm taking it, I apologize to whomever that is. But what they essentially do is they argue not in favor of pure public good, but what is famously termed, I'm sure many people have heard of, public-private partnership, right? Is that the American government would essentially serve as a contracting force where it would contract to private groups to provide public goods. Right. And initially this occurred in things like research and in weapons development, but it didn't really occur in areas like policing or the military. However, over the last 25, 30, 35 years, we've seen the spread of the contract state into areas that were had always really been considered since the early 20th century to be properly public functions, like the army, like fighting America's wars, or fighting or policing communities. So what we've seen in the last several decades is this spread, the embrace of private, basically mercenaries to fight American wars abroad and private police forces to police American communities at home. And this, in the United States, at least as far as I know, this is mostly, if not totally, confined to rich communities. So in the city I'm in, Los Angeles, it actually has, the LAPD is actually relatively small, especially when you compare it to New York City's police department. But instead, a lot of towns and municipalities like Beverly Hills, I believe, if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I believe Beverly Hills have their own private police forces, right? This was actually represented famously in the Big Lebowski. Remember, he goes to Malibu and it's like kind of their own private police force, yeah, that police the communities, the norms of the community, right? This is something that you're increasingly seeing. So what we've seen in the United States is the privatization, ironically, of this fundamental feature that I just called the American state, which is the legitimate use of violence. And that's just a part of the longer process of hollowing out state authority, where things that are, I mean, it'd be difficult if you ask someone, if you ask an American on the street, just anyone of basically any community or identity group, should the army and should the police be private or funded by the government, or, you know, government employees, I think the overwhelming majority would say government employees, even though that's not actually what's been going on. Then this is also made even more damaging and problematic by the fact of the militarization of the American police. And I believe I've mentioned it on this program before, but Stuart Schrader's book, Badges Without Borders, which recently came out, is really excellent in showing the direct connection between American imperial actions abroad and the militarization of American police at home. Stuart traces it from the 1960s era in Vietnam, but this goes back all the way to the War of 1898 and the American occupation of the Philippines, where a lot of tactics and strategies that were developed to police colonial territories abroad were then imported back home to police American communities, particularly, unsurprisingly, as I just talked about, the relationship between racism and policing is foundational, particularly colonial policing methods were brought home to police internally colonized communities, African Americans, indigenous communities, Latino communities, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a problem that's been going on for a long time that I think is just reaching its height right now because of things are being filmed, for lack of a better phrase, that a lot of things that have remained under the radar to sort of the median white voter, white citizen are becoming increasingly apparent. So this is a problem, I would say, endemic to the structure of American policing and American use of violence to contain its own population. And that is just beginning to be questioned in a way that it should have been for decades, if not at least a century.
So let's pivot a little bit. In every section of this conversation, this is kind of an awkward transition, but it actually makes sense. Historicizing things. There's few public exercises more important than historically situating where we are that helps give us a material view of reality, that helps us understand the velocity and trajectory of institutions and different patterns of politics and economics. And so history is a really important ground, and it's certainly a contested ground, you know, the sort of fights about how we're going to process the past and, you know, how we're going to understand where we came from and so on. But in, you know, more recent years, and in this, you know, piece that you've sent me, which is a review of a really fascinating new book called The Gig Economy and the Meritocracy Trap, you're talking about how what is a major labor story, which is this complete gutting out of the academy, and the undermining of the academic job market, you know, certainly in humanities and social sciences, also has really big public implications for basically the capacity to think publicly and understand who we are and where we came from, where we're going.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's actually connected to what's going on in terms of the outbreaks of rage and the unemployment crisis, because what's happened to American universities is that they've basically taken on features of the so-called gig economy. What is meant by the gig economy? The Amazon warehouse worker who isn't given enough hours to earn healthcare, the Uber driver, the subcontracted cafeteria worker. These are all people who have a general experience of precarity, which I do think is contributing to the rage that we're seeing throughout the United States on all sides of the political spectrum. So what's happened over the last 30 years, so there's actually a direct connection of precarity. And I think an experience of precarity really unites most American workers across collars, from blue to white collar to one could add the gigging journalist. Right. And so one member of the gig economy is the adjunct professor or the staff worker at part-time staff worker at universities, or the subcontracted cafeteria or maintenance worker at a university who basically works on contract. So just to give a little bit of background, in the last 30 years, the American system of higher education has undergone a process of neoliberal corporatization, where essentially jobs that were considered they were relatively stable in the past. For example, a professor, an administrative assistant to the dean or what have you, or a maintenance worker or a janitor at a university. Jobs that were pretty much relatively stable have been adjunctified or precariatized. As university administrators, informed by a neoliberal ideology, have sought to cut costs at the expense of pretty much everything else. So, for example, roughly 75% of professors in American universities are not what are considered tenure track professors. There's no way to get tenure that is a permanent job. And that's problematic because when you have tenure, you're able to be controversial, like, for example, I am on Twitter, and more importantly, teach controversial topics or research controversial topics without fear of being fired. So what's happened now in university systems is that basically everyone is precarious. So why does this matter? It matters first and foremost because study after study has demonstrated that precarious professors, precarious staff members, precarious university workers are not able to develop the types of relationships that they've traditionally been able to develop with students, which leads to just negative student outcomes. Fewer people graduate from college. Fewer people are able to transfer from 2 to 4 year universities. There's a rise in student depression. There's a decline in student achievements, generally speaking, because learning, as we all know, is social. And if you're not able to develop social relationships, if professors aren't able to develop social relationships with their students, students suffer. So first and foremost, as college ironically has increased in price, and as students have taken out tens of thousands of dollars in debt to attend college, the university educations have actually gotten worse because more workers are precarious. So that's one. And two, what is really important to me as someone who's dedicated themselves to research, and I'm sure to many people who are listening who care about things like history, right? The historicization is a very important political act. It helps us denaturalize the past. I mean, it helps us denaturalize the present and see that there are other alternatives, is that you just are seeing a decline in knowledge production. So histories that would have been written in the past are just not being written, because when you're an adjunct professor, you get paid $3,000 a class, and you're working at six different universities to make whatever, $20,000 a year. You're not really able to devote yourself to research and the production of new knowledge. And this is especially true in the humanities and social sciences, but it is also true in the sciences. And it basically just leads to a terrible life. So one of my good friends, a guy named David Parsons, who actually hosts an excellent podcast called The Nostalgia Trap, I recommend everyone listen to it. He was just fired at no notice in the autumn. He works for the California State University system, and he just received an email saying, sorry, enrollments are down, you're fired. So he's out of a job, and he's not going to be able to do anything to basically make an income. And this experience is paradigmatic of people throughout the gig economy. And the gig academy. So it's paradigmatic of the gig academy, which is reflective of the larger gig economy. So I just wanted to highlight this because I do think university, American the American university system is about to face an apocalypse. That COVID-19 is going to slash states' budgets, which have already been slashed in the last 20, 30 years, particularly after the 2008 crisis. And perhaps even more importantly, it's going to prevent a lot of foreign students from enrolling at American universities. So what happened after the 2008 crisis is that in order to make up for budget shortfalls by the state, universities switched to enrolling more foreign students because, frankly, they pay more for higher education. But if these people aren't going to be able to come back to the United States, either because Trump does something, as seems to be happening today, or because they're afraid of contracting COVID-19, or if they're afraid of racism and xenophobia, the American university system is going to experience a serious budget shortfall. So I'm just emphasizing this because if people care about education, they care about history, they care about the production of new knowledge, we need to basically all come together and persuade our fellow Americans and also state legislators about the importance of university education, both because it's the right thing to do and both because we want to be a society that has a history.
How can we track this incredible paradox that there used to be much more of an understanding in, say, the kind of post-World War II through the 60s, that education was in some sense a public good, that people from different class backgrounds should have access, going to college shouldn't be prohibitive there. And at the same time, there was certainly, much clearer doorways into the middle class or the professional class if you had that capacity, in terms of, if you could make it through law school, you were probably going to get a good job. Now, of course, there's all sorts of other factors that play in, and nepotism and social networks and everything else. Absolutely. But there was this funny paradox where it wasn't, there was a lot less of an ideology of education needing to have a specific economic output, even as it did have an economic output. In the last several decades, it's turned into just a calling card and a brand, even as the power of that brand has diminished significantly in terms of what it will actually buy you in employment opportunities and income in the marketplace.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So I'll try to keep this brief. So in the last three decades, I think that shift is due to the rise of neoliberal ideology, and that's reflected in a variety of ways. Perhaps most importantly, you begin to see things like the Board of Regents of university boards of regents throughout the country, instead of consisting of sort of community leaders and most importantly, retired academics. You begin to see like corporate leaders move into boards of regents. And with that happening, you begin to see the imposition of a corporate logic onto the American university system, which is at least in its ideal form and wasn't really a business, but it started to be treated like a business. Universities become obsessed, for example, with maintaining control of patents that are created on their system. Google was founded by two Stanford University graduates, and Stanford didn't on Stanford equipment, and Stanford didn't get anything. And so there's that sort of anxiety about getting the product of your research. But what's also interesting is I think that we can't, unfortunately, separate the explosion of higher education in the late 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s from the Cold War. So on one hand, a deal was essentially made between the government and white soldiers in the United States, where because they fought World War II, they were going to be able to get a higher degree, and that would have been an engine for social mobility. But also crucially, the American government begins to really fund the higher education system in 1958. Why? What happens in 1957? The Soviets launched Sputnik, the first satellite in space. And so that fear of Sputnik basically freaks out the American government, and they begin to pour millions of dollars into American university systems, basically to ensure that we have a scientifically educated populace. So there's always been, at least in the moment of its greatest explosion, the American university system has always been informed by a security logic. And perhaps, unfortunately, you see that happening today, right? I'm reading a book right now for a future review, and the argument made for higher education is that if we want to compete with China, we need to have a highly educated populace. So what I'm hoping to do, right, exactly.
And that's the same day there's legislation from Cotton and Blackburn, just this kind of most rank embarrassing xenophobia about blocking Chinese graduate students from STEM.
Exactly. So just to wrap up, what I'm curious about is whether it's possible in this country to have a funding of higher education that's not directly linked to security, to national security logics. We haven't had it, really. And I hope we can, but I'm a little bit pessimistic.
How would this relate then? I mean, you know, there's having a bigger public argument, which is really important, but I think is obviously going to be very hard because obviously we're in a depression. There's another wave of austerity. You know, all sorts of immediate and material needs are under attack. And then other than a kind of broad public argument, which is important, what's the sort of concrete mechanism? Like you occasionally hear just as, and I think one of the actual elements of this precarity economy is sort of, all right, well, I mean, these workers are on strike. Great. Maybe we can, you know, at least, you know, talk about these McDonald's workers or talk, you know, give them some attention or maybe, you know, or obviously if you have the capacity and there's a GoFundMe that's real, you know, you can donate to a strike fund. You know, these things are concrete and important and tangible, but that hasn't been sort of systematized yet. You know, yeah.
No, I think that's exactly. Yeah, I do think there's two things. And I just want to highlight a lot of the information I'm talking about comes from this excellent book called The Gig Academy by Kazar, Scott, and DePaola. So if anyone wants more details, please check that book out. But I think essentially that there are two ways to do it. One, within the American university, professors for the first time in U.S. history share a work experience that is far more similar to staff and subcontracted maintenance and cafeteria workers and the like than they ever have before. So within universities themselves, you can't limit things like unionization just to professors, but you have to take all jobs together. And I think that's actually true across the economy. Sectoral. Again, the life of an I think it's called cross occupation organizing when you're doing it within an industry, and then also cross sectoral organizing in the sense that the life of an adjunct professor is much more similar to an Amazon worker than not. So I think that, again, you need the sort of within the university cross occupational organizing, and then without the university cross sectoral organizing. And this is actually really important, I think, question for organizing theorists is that in the absence of the factory, right, the single location where people go to day after day and form social bonds and form communities. Nowadays, you have like the Uber driver who's totally alienated and doesn't know her or his fellow colleagues, right? So how do you basically get workers to have consciousness of the shared experience of precarity, both within and without their industry? Because I personally think this is a shared experience across the American political economy that we need to be centering as a left. Now that's a really difficult question, but I think that's the only way that we're going to get any sort of transformation. I think if you, for example, just unionize union workers or just unionize adjunct professors, that you might get short victories or short-term victories, but you won't get the sort of transformational victory in the political economy that we actually need. It's a really difficult question. I don't have an answer, but I think those are two meaningful strategies, and the authors of the Gig Academy talk about both at more length.
I actually asked President Lula about that when I interviewed him. Because he was talking a lot about, you know, since he was released from political imprisonment, one of the things he talked about in one of his first rally speeches was actually the Uberization of Brazil and how that was related to, you know, attacks on unions and pensioners. And, you know, he definitely, I mean, he had some very important and, you know, visceral instincts, as he would, about, you know, he had this image that he painted of, like, you know, somebody's like, you know, it's pouring rain and they're on a scooter and they're like delivering your pizza, essentially. And, you know, they have no foundation, and no respect from the government, and no bonds. And, you know, essentially, like, that's like the new person. Like, if, you know, people should watch the interview, but like that needs to be the kind of center of the decision-making and policy-making today. But it also was definitely, you know, yeah, it's tricky because just even physically the foundations of, you know, you don't want to idealize like being a metal worker or something is not fun. But you know, you're hundreds of people, you're in the same spot. You're also not as totally surveilled as you are in an Amazon work, you know, warehouse today, where your, you know, your every micro movement is being processed and, you know, a terror. I mean, this is one of the reasons, you know, the Amazon has a higher rate of injuries on the job, because you're, you know, every step is quantified to maximize efficiency. So yeah.
These right. Are which is just barriers, sort of, exactly. And that's an upshot of sort of Taylorist management strategy of the early 20th century, where he was literally, you know, measuring movements in order to try to get, you know, the most efficient thing. And I think when we look back on it, you know, even in 5-10 years time, we'll see that one of the things that neoliberal economic practices did was that they destroyed social bonds. And that those are, of course, social bonds, community bonds are one of the foundations of solidarity. And so that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to overcome a political economy that is clearly not benefiting the overwhelming majority of not only Americans, but people in the world, is that these social connections are just totally destroyed. Started with deindustrialization, is now basically reached its apotheosis, where you know, the algorithm is determining who gets what and who is employed, right? Another interesting thing I just want to mention is that this has actually come along with the destruction of middle management, right? You don't need middle managers anymore. Algorithms have essentially replaced middle managers. So it's important, because this is an experience that is not just traditional blue collar, it is also traditional white collar, right? And it really, and you see that by the fact that I just mentioned that Amazon warehouse workers and adjunct professors, people with PhDs, share a lot more in common than they did ever before in American history. And so this is, I think, a really crucial thing to center, as Lula said, now and going forward until we, you know, reach a post-capitalist society.
Well, Daniel Bessner, appreciate your time as always. Everybody check out Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier, The Rise of Defense Intellectuals, which actually, as you can see in the course of this conversation, can give us some insight on this situation as well. And of course, you can follow Daniel on Twitter and, you know, read his writing and in all the places that you would expect to see writing like this. So Daniel Bessner, thanks a lot, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael. Take it easy. Bye.
Take care. Bye. All right, folks. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how you get the whole thing. Check out Just Coffee, Tea, Chocolate, and Tea, Coffee, and Chocolate. That's a great thing. That's a model we need to be supporting, the co-op model, very important. On Tuesday's Michael Brooks Show, we talked with Dustin Dino Guastella of the Teamsters local in Philadelphia, and also Philadelphia DSA. We talked about why Bernie lost, why we need a class war, not a culture war, strategy moving forward, and seeding candidates from the labor movement, what that actually looks like on state levels. Second part of our two-part illicit histories of the rise of modern communication and propaganda with Mark Ames, and how that relates to the history of shock therapy and neoliberalism in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we're working on another two-part illicit history on Pakistan from today, Imran Khan, back to the foundations of the Saudi-U.S. Mujahideen relationship and how it affects the world we're in today. Check out Michael Brooks' show on YouTube. Go to patreon.com/TMBS. And, of course, snag a copy of Against the Web, Cosmopolitan Answers to the New Right. Great new review of it written by the very smart, very insightful Ralph Leonard. Matt, what's cooking? You're muted.
Tonight, twitch.tv/literary hangover, I will be doing probably another stream on Red Dead Redemption and Fatal Environment by Richard Slotka, The Myth of the Frontier and the Age of Industrialization.
When Cornel West mentioned that,
I've been crushing it with, I forget what the other reference was, but I think Zizek, or maybe it was Adolf Reed reference, another...
Adolf Reed. It was an Adolf Reed book about the founding.
About
something like what was it? It was that was a provocative title. It was like something on.
It was Anxious Ender, Patriarchs.
It was like Anxious Patriarchs.
Nasty Wenches and something else by Kathleen Brown about.
So yes, that's the one Adolf mentioned to us.
Yeah, and it's about how the sort of Virginia government in the 1600s. Basically used race and race and gender specifically, like codified those into law in ways that would develop into, we could naturalize them nowadays. But yeah. So check that out, twitch.tv/literaryhangover.
And also you could check it out, of course, on Patreon and subscribe on iTunes. Jamie, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right.
What's cooking?
Cool. So this week on the Antifada, we had on Winnie Wong, a former senior advisor to the Bernie Sanders campaign. More importantly, for our purposes, an anarchist, as well as a UFO, someone who takes an interest in UFOs. Ooh. So we had a nice long talk with her about the Bernie campaign, what went wrong, where we can go from here, and how it fits into her overarching radical political horizon. We also released an episode this week that Sean did with Terrence from Trillbillies. In our feed, it was a cross post about Arrighi's The Long 20th Century and World Systems Theory. It's really interesting. I learned a lot from it. I encourage everyone to check it out. Also, I just have to re-up my recommendation. If you want a different take on prison abolition and police abolition and why they are crucially important for the left to care about, check out our episode with Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing, as well as our episode with Nadja from No New Jails.
All right, we're going to see you guys in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.